Listening Library presents The Trials of Apollo, Book 2, The Dark Prophecy, by Rick Riordan, read for you by Robbie Damon. To Ursula K. Le Guin, who taught me that rules change in the reaches. 1. Lester, Apollo. Still human, thanks for asking. Gods, I hate my life. When our dragon declared war on Indiana, I knew it was going to be a bad day. We'd been traveling west for 6 weeks, and Festus had never shown such hostility toward a state. New Jersey, he ignored. Pennsylvania, he seemed to enjoy, despite our battle with the Cyclopes of Pittsburgh. Ohio, he tolerated. Even after our encounter with Patina, the Roman goddess of childhood drinks, who pursued us in the form of a giant red pitcher emblazoned with a smiley face. Yet, for some reason, Festus decided he did not like Indiana. He landed on the cupola of the Indiana State House, flapped his metallic wings, and blew a cone of fire that incinerated the state flag right off the flagpole. "Whoa, buddy!" Leo Valdez pulled the dragon's reins. "We've talked about this. No blowtorching public monuments." Behind him on the dragon's spine, Calypso gripped Festus's scales for balance. "Could we please get to the ground? Gently this time?" For a formerly immortal sorceress who once controlled air spirits, Calypso was not a fan of flying. Cold wind blew her chestnut hair into my face, making me blink and spit. That's right, dear reader. I, the most important passenger, the youth who had once been the glorious god Apollo, was forced to sit in the back of the dragon. Oh, the indignities I had suffered since Zeus stripped me of my divine powers. It wasn't enough that I was now a 16-year-old mortal with the ghastly alias Lester Papadopoulos. It wasn't enough that I had to toil upon the earth doing, heroic quests until I could find a way back into my father's good graces, or that I had a case of acne which simply would not respond to over-the-counter zit medicine. Despite my New York State junior driver's license, Leo Valdez didn't trust me to operate his aerial bronze steed. Festus's claws scrabbled for a hold on the green copper dome, which was much too small for a dragon his size. I had a flashback to the time I installed a life-size statue of the muse Calliope on my sun chariot, and the extra weight of the hood ornament made me nosedive into China and create the Gobi Desert. Leo glanced back, his face streaked with soot. "Apollo, you sense anything?" "Why is it my job to sense things? Just because I used to be a god of prophecy?" "You're the one who's been having visions," Calypso reminded me. "You said your friend Meg would be here." Just hearing Meg's name gave me a twinge of pain. "That doesn't mean I can pinpoint her location with my mind. Zeus has revoked my access to GPS.
"GPS?" Calypso asked.
"Godly positioning systems."
"That's not a real thing."
"Guys, cool it."
Leo patted the dragon's neck.
"Apollo, just try, will you? Does this look like the city you dreamed about or not?"
I scanned the horizon. Indiana was flat country. Highways crisscrossing scrubby brown plains. Shadows of winter clouds floating above urban sprawl. Around us rose a meager cluster of downtown high-rises. Stacks of stone and glass, like layered wedges of black and white licorice. Not the yummy kind of licorice, either. The nasty variety that sits for eons in your stepmother's candy bowl on the coffee table. And no, Hera, why would I be talking about you? After falling to earth in New York City, I found Indianapolis desolate and uninspiring. As if one proper New York neighborhood, Midtown perhaps, had been stretched out to encompass the entire area of Manhattan, then relieved of 2/3 of its population and vigorously power-washed. I could think of no reason why an evil triumvirate of ancient Roman emperors would take interest in such a location. Nor could I imagine why Meg McCaffrey would be sent here to capture me. Yet my visions had been clear. I had seen this skyline. I had heard my old enemy Nero give orders to Meg. Go west. Capture Apollo before he can find the next oracle. If you cannot bring him to me alive, kill him. The truly sad thing about this, Meg was one of my better friends. She also happened to be my demigod master, thanks to Zeus's twisted sense of humor. As long as I remained mortal, Meg could order me to do anything. Even kill myself. No, better not to think of such possibilities. I shifted in my metal seat. After so many weeks of travel, I was tired and saddle sore. I wanted to find a safe place to rest. This was not such a city. Something about the landscape below made me as restless as Festus. Alas, I was sure this was where we were meant to be. Despite the danger, if I had a chance of seeing Meg McCaffrey again, of prying her away from her villainous stepfather's grasp, I had to try. This is the spot, I said. Before this dome collapses under us, I suggest we get to the ground. Calypso grumbled in ancient Minoan. I already said that. Well, excuse me, sorceress, I replied in the same language. Perhaps if you had helpful visions, I'd listen to you more often. Calypso called me a few names that reminded me how colorful the Minoan language had been before it went extinct. Hey, you two, Leo said. No ancient dialects. Spanish or English, please. Or machine. Festus creaked in agreement. It's okay, boy, Leo said. I'm sure they didn't mean to exclude us. Now let's fly down to street level, huh? Festus's ruby eyes glowed. His metal teeth spun like drill bits. I imagined him thinking, Illinois is sounding pretty good right about now. But he flapped his wings and leaped from the dome. We hurtled downward, landing in front of the state house with enough force to crack the sidewalk. My eyeballs jiggled like water balloons. Festus whipped his head from side to side, steam curling from his nostrils. I saw no immediate threats. Cars drove leisurely down West Washington Street. Pedestrians strolled by. A middle-aged woman in a flowery dress. A heavy-set policeman carrying a paper coffee cup labeled Café Patachou. A clean-cut man in a blue seersucker suit. The man in blue waved politely as he passed. Morning. Sup, dude? Leo called. Calypso tilted her head. Why was he so friendly? Does he not see that we're sitting atop a 50-ton metal dragon? Leo grinned. It's the mist, babe. Messes with mortal eyes. Makes monsters look like stray dogs. Makes swords look like umbrellas. Makes me look even more handsome than usual. Calypso jabbed her thumbs into Leo's kidneys. Ow! He complained.
I know what the mist is, Leonidas.
Hey, I told you never to call me that.
But the mist must be very strong here if it can hide a monster of Festus's size at such close range. Apollo, don't you find that a little odd?
I studied the passing pedestrians. True, I had seen places where the mist was particularly heavy. At Troy, the sky above the battlefield had been so thick with gods you couldn't turn your chariot without running into another deity. Yet the Trojans and Greeks saw only hints of our presence. At Three Mile Island in 1979,
The mortals somehow failed to realize that their partial nuclear meltdown was caused by an epic chainsaw fight between Ares and Hephaestus. As I recall, Hephaestus had insulted Ares's bell-bottom jeans. Still, I did not think heavy mist was the problem here. Something about these locals bothered me. Their faces were too placid. Their dazed smiles reminded me of ancient Athenians just before the Dionysus festival. Everyone in a good mood, distracted, thinking about the drunken riots and debauchery to come. "We should get out of the public eye," I suggested. "Perhaps..." Festus stumbled, shaking like a wet dog. From inside his chest came a noise like a loose bicycle chain. "Aw, not again," Leo said. "Everybody off!" Calypso and I quickly dismounted. Leo ran in front of Festus and held out his arms in a classic dragon wrangler stance. "Hey, buddy, it's fine. I'm just going to switch you off for a while, okay? A little downtime to..." Festus projectile vomited a column of flames that engulfed Leo. Fortunately, Valdez was fireproof. His clothes were not. From what Leo had told me, he could generally prevent his outfits from burning up simply by concentrating. If he were caught by surprise, however, it didn't always work. When the flames dissipated, Leo stood before us wearing nothing but his asbestos boxer shorts, his magical tool belt, and a pair of smoking, partially melted sneakers. "Dang it," he complained. "Festus, it's cold out here." The dragon stumbled. Leo lunged and flipped the lever behind the dragon's left foreleg. Festus began to collapse. His wings, limbs, neck, and tail contracted into his body, his bronze plates overlapping and folding inward. In a matter of seconds, our robotic friend had been reduced to a large bronze suitcase. That should have been physically impossible, of course, but like any decent god, demigod, or engineer, Leo Valdez refused to be stopped by the laws of physics. He scowled at his new piece of luggage. "Man, I thought I fixed his gyrocapacitor. Guess we're stuck here until I can find a machine shop." Calypso grimaced. Her pink ski jacket glistened with condensation from our flight through the clouds. "And if we find such a shop, how long will it take to repair Festus?" Leo shrugged. 12 hours, 15. He pushed a button on the side of the suitcase. A handle popped up. "Also, if we see a men's clothing store, that might be good." I imagined walking into a TJ Maxx, Leo in boxer shorts and melted sneakers, rolling a bronze suitcase behind him. I did not relish the idea. Then, from the direction of the sidewalk, a voice called. "Hello?" The woman in the flowery dress had returned. At least, she looked like the same woman. Either that, or lots of ladies in Indianapolis wore purple and yellow honeysuckle patterned dresses and had 1950s bouffant hairstyles. She smiled vacantly. "Beautiful morning." It was, in fact, a miserable morning, cold and cloudy with a smell of impending snow. But I felt it would be rude to ignore her completely. I gave her a little parade wave, a sort of gesture I used to give my worshippers when they came to grovel at my altar. To me, the message was clear enough. "I see you, puny mortal. Now run along. The gods are talking." The woman did not take the hint. She strolled forward and planted herself in front of us. She wasn't particularly large, but something about her proportions seemed off. Her shoulders were too wide for her head. Her chest and belly protruded in a lumpy mass, as if she'd stuffed a sack of mangoes down the front of her dress. With her spindly arms and legs, she reminded me of some sort of giant beetle. If she ever tipped over, I doubted she could easily get back up.
Oh, my. She gripped her purse with both hands. Aren't you children cute?
Her lipstick and eyeshadow were both a violent shade of purple. I wondered if she was getting enough oxygen to her brain.
Madam, I said, we are not children.
I could have added that I was over 4,000 years old and Calypso was even older, but I decided not to get into that.
Now, if you'll excuse us, we have a suitcase to repair, and my friend is in dire need of a pair of pants.
I tried to step around her. She blocked my path.
You can't go yet, dear. We haven't welcomed you to Indiana.
From her purse, she drew a smartphone. The screen glowed as if a call were already in progress.
It's him, all right, she said into the phone. Everybody, come on over. Apollo is here.
My lungs shriveled in my chest. In the old days, I would have expected to be recognized as soon as I arrived in a town. Of course the locals would rush to welcome me. They would sing and dance and throw flowers. They would immediately begin constructing a new temple. But as Lester Papadopoulos, I did not warrant such treatment. I looked nothing like my former glorious self. The idea that the Indianans might recognize me despite my tangled hair, acne, and flab was both insulting and terrifying. What if they erected a statue of me in my present form? A giant golden Lester in the center of their city. The other gods would never let me hear the end of it.
Madam, I said, I'm afraid you have mistaken me. Don't be modest.
The woman tossed her phone and purse aside. She grabbed my forearm with the strength of a weightlifter.
Our master will be delighted to have you in custody. And please, call me Nanette.
Calypso charged. Either she wished to defend me, unlikely, or she was not a fan of the name Nanette. She punched the woman in the face.
This by itself did not surprise me. Having lost her immortal powers, Calypso was in the process of trying to master other skills. So far, she'd failed at swords, pole arms, shurikens, whips, and improvisational comedy. I sympathized with her frustration. Today, she'd decided to try fisticuffs. What surprised me was the loud crack her fist made against Nanette's face, the sound of finger bones breaking.
Ow!
Calypso stumbled away, clutching her hand. Nanette's head slid backward. She released me to try to grab her own face, but it was too late. Her head toppled off her shoulders. It clanged against the pavement and rolled sideways, the eyes still blinking, the purple lips twitching. Its base was smooth stainless steel. Attached to it were ragged strips of duct tape stuck with hair and bobby pins.
Holy Hephaestus!
Leo ran to Calypso's side.
Lady, you broke my girlfriend's hand with your face!
What are you, an automaton?
No, dear, said decapitated Nanette.
Her muffled voice didn't come from the stainless steel head on the sidewalk. It emanated from somewhere inside her dress. Just above her collar, where her neck used to be, an outcropping of fine blonde hair was tangled with bobby pins.
And I must say, hitting me wasn't very polite.
Belatedly, I realized the metal head had been a disguise. Just as satyrs covered their hooves with human shoes, this creature passed for mortal by pretending to have a human face. Its voice came from its gut area, which meant... My knees trembled.
A blemii, I said.
Nanette chuckled. Her bulging midsection writhed under the honeysuckle cloth. She ripped open her blouse, something a polite Midwesterner would never think of doing.
and revealed her true face. Where a woman's brassiere would have been, two enormous bulging eyes blinked at me. From her sternum protruded a large shiny nose. Across her abdomen curled a hideous mouth, glistening orange lips, teeth like a spread of blank white playing cards. "Yes, dear," the face said, "and I'm arresting you in the name of the Triumvirate." Up and down Washington Street, pleasant-looking pedestrians turned and began marching in our direction. 2. Headless guys and gals, not loving the Midwest vibe. Oh, look, a cheese ghost. "Gee, Apollo," you may be thinking, "why didn't you simply pull out your bow and shoot her? Or charm her with a song from your combat ukulele?" True, I had both those items slung across my back, along with my quiver. Sadly, even the best demigod weapons require something called maintenance. My children, Kayla and Austin, had explained this to me before I left Camp Half-Blood. I couldn't just pull my bow and quiver out of thin air as I used to when I was a god. I could no longer wish my ukulele into my hands and expect it to be perfectly in tune. My weapons and my musical instrument were carefully wrapped in blankets. Otherwise, flying through the wet winter skies would have warped the bow, ruined the arrows, and played Hades with the strings of my ukulele. To get them out now would require several minutes that I did not have. Also, I doubted they would do me much good against Polemiae. I hadn't dealt with their kind since the time of Julius Caesar, and I would have been happy to go another 2,000 years without seeing one. How could a god of poetry and music be effective against a species whose ears were wedged under their armpits? Nor did the Blemii fear or respect archery. They were sturdy melee fighters with thick skin. They were even resistant to most forms of disease, which meant they never called on me for medical help, nor feared my plague arrows. Worst of all, they were humorless and unimaginative. They had no interest in the future, so they saw no use for oracles or prophecies. In short, you could not create a race less sympathetic to an attractive, multi-talented god like me. And believe me, Ares had tried. Those 18th-century Hessian mercenaries he cooked up? Ugh. George Washington and I had the worst time with them. "Leo," I said, "activate the dragon." "I just put him into sleep cycle." "Hurry!" Leo fumbled with the suitcase's buttons. Nothing happened. "I told you, man. Even if Festus weren't malfunctioning, he's really hard to wake up once he's asleep." "Wonderful," I thought. Calypso hunched over her broken hand, muttering Minoan obscenities. Leo shivered in his underwear. And I was Lester. On top of all that, instead of facing our enemies with a large fire-breathing automaton, we would now have to face them with a barely portable piece of metal luggage. I wheeled on the Blemii. "Be gone, foul Nanette!" I tried to muster my old godly wrath voice. "Lay hands upon my divine person again, and you shall be destroyed!" Back when I was a god, that threat would have been enough to make entire armies wet their camouflage pants. Nanette just blinked her cow-brown eyes. "Don't fuss now," she said. Her lips were grotesquely hypnotic, like watching a surgical incision being used as a puppet. "Besides, dearie, you're not a god anymore." Why did people have to keep reminding me of that? More locals converged on our position. Two police officers trotted down the steps of the state house. At the corner of Senate Avenue, a trio of sanitation workers abandoned their garbage truck and lumbered over, wielding large metal trash cans.
From the other direction, a half-dozen men in business suits tromped across the Capitol lawn.
Leo cursed.
Is everybody in this town a metalhead? And I don't mean the good kind of metalhead.
Relax, sweetie, Nanette said.
Surrender, and we won't have to hurt you much. That's the Emperor's job.
Despite her broken hand, Calypso apparently didn't feel like surrendering. With a defiant yell, she charged Nanette again, this time launching a karate kick toward the Blemmyai's giant nose.
Don't! I blurted out.
Too late. As I mentioned, Blemmyai are sturdy beings. They're difficult to hurt, and even more difficult to kill. Calypso's foot connected with its target, and her ankle bent with a nasty pop. She collapsed, gurgling in pain.
Cal!
Leo ran to her side.
Back off, chest face!
Language, dear, Nanette chided.
Now I'm afraid I'll have to stomp on you.
She raised one patent leather pump, but Leo was faster. He summoned a globe of fire and threw it like a baseball, hitting Nanette right between her huge chest-level eyes. Flames washed over her, setting her eyebrows and flowery dress ablaze. As Nanette screamed and stumbled, Leo yelled,
Apollo, help me!
I realized I'd been standing there, frozen in shock, which would have been fine if I'd been watching the scene unfold from the safety of my throne on Mount Olympus. Alas, I was very much down here in the trenches with the lesser beings. I helped get Calypso to her feet, her one good foot at least. We slung her arms over our shoulders, with lots of screaming from Calypso when I accidentally grabbed her broken hand and began hobbling away. 30 feet across the lawn, Leo suddenly stopped.
I forgot Festus. Leave him, I snapped. What?
We can't manage him and Calypso.
We'll come back later. The Blemmyai might just ignore him.
But if they figure out how to open him, Leo fretted.
If they hurt him. Marr!
Behind us, Nanette ripped off the shreds of her burning dress. From the waist down, shaggy blonde fur covered her body, not unlike a satyr. Her eyebrows smoldered, but otherwise her face looked unhurt. She spat ashes from her mouth and glared in our direction.
That was not nice. Get them.
The businessmen were almost on top of us, eliminating any hope that we could make it back to Festus without getting caught. We chose the only heroic option available. We ran. I hadn't felt so encumbered since my three-legged death race with Meg McCaffrey back at Camp Half-Blood. Calypso tried to help, kicking along like a pogo stick between Leo and me. But whenever she jostled her broken foot or hand, she yelped and sagged against us.
Sorry, guys, she muttered, her face beaded with sweat. Guess I'm not meant to be a melee fighter.
Neither am I admitted.
Perhaps Leo can hold them off while... Hey, don't look at me, Leo grumbled. I'm just a repair guy who can throw the occasional fireball. Our fighter is stuck back there in suitcase mode.
Hobble faster, I suggested. We reached the street alive only because the Blemmyai moved so slowly. I suppose I would, too, if I were balancing a fake metal head on my... head. But even without their disguises, the Blemmyai were not as swift as they were strong. Their terrible depth perception made them walk with exaggerated caution, as if the ground were a multi-layered hologram. If only we could out-hobble them.
Good morning!
A police officer appeared on our right, his firearm drawn.
Halt, or I will shoot. Thank you.
Leo pulled a stoppered glass bottle from his tool belt. He tossed it at the officer's feet, and green flames exploded around him. The officer dropped his gun. He began tearing off his burning uniform,
revealing a chest face with shaggy pectoral eyebrows and a belly beard in need of a shave.
Phew, Leo said. I was hoping he was a Blemyai. That was my only vial of Greek fire, guys. Then I can't keep summoning fireballs unless I want to pass out, so...
We need to find cover, said Calypso.
Sensible advice, but cover did not seem to be an Indiana concept. The streets were wide and straight, the landscape flat, the crowd sparse, the sightlines endless. We turned onto South Capitol. I glanced over my shoulder and saw the mob of smiling, fake-headed locals gaining on us. A construction worker stopped to rip the fender off a Ford pickup, then rejoined the parade, his new chrome club slung over his shoulder. Meanwhile, the regular mortals, at least those who did not seem interested in killing us at the moment, went about their business, making phone calls, waiting at traffic lights, sipping coffee in nearby cafes, completely ignoring us. At one corner, sitting on a milk crate, a heavily blanketed homeless man asked me for change. I resisted the urge to tell him that change was coming up fast behind us, carrying assorted weapons. My heart pounded. My legs shook. I hated having a mortal body. I experienced so many bothersome things, like fear, cold, nausea, and the impulse to whimper, "Please don't kill me." If only Calypso hadn't broken her ankle, we might have moved faster. But we couldn't very well leave her behind. Not that I particularly liked Calypso, mind you, but I'd already convinced Leo to abandon his dragon. I didn't want to push my luck.
There, said the sorceress.
She pointed with her chin to what looked like a service alley behind a hotel. I shuddered, remembering my first day in New York as Lester Papadopoulos. What if it's a dead end? The last time I found myself in a dead-end alley, things did not go well.
Let's try, Leo said. We might be able to hide in there, or... I don't know.
I don't know sounded like a sketchy plan B, but I had nothing better to offer. Good news, the alley was not a dead end. I could clearly see an exit at the far end of the block. Bad news? The loading bays along the back of the hotel were locked, giving us nowhere to hide, and the opposite wall of the alley was lined with dumpsters. Oh, dumpsters. How I hated them. Leo sighed.
I guess we could jump in.
No, I snapped. Never again. We struggled through the alley as fast as we could. I tried to calm my nerves by silently composing a sonnet about various ways a wrathful god could destroy dumpsters. I became so engrossed, I didn't notice what was in front of us until Calypso gasped. Leo halted.
What the? Yeehaw!
The apparition glowed with a faint ginger light. He wore a traditional chiton, sandals, and a sheathed sword, like a Greek warrior in the prime of life. Except for the fact that he had been decapitated. Unlike the Blemyai, however, this person obviously had once been human. Ethereal blood trickled from his severed neck, splattering his luminous orange tunic.
It's a cheese-colored ghost, Leo said.
The spirit raised one hand, beckoning us forward. Not being born a mortal, I had no particular fear of the dead.
You've seen one tormented soul, you've seen them all.
But something about this ghost unsettled me. He stirred a distant memory, a feeling of guilt from thousands of years ago. Behind us, the voices of the Blemyai grew louder. I heard them calling out,
"Morning!"
and,
"Excuse me!"
and,
"Lovely day!"
to their fellow Indianans.
What do we do? Calypso asked. Follow the ghost, I said.
What?
Leo yelped.
We follow the cheese-colored ghost. As you're always saying,
Vaya con queso,
That was a joke, Esse.
The orange spirit beckoned again, then floated toward the end of the alley. Behind us, a man's voice shouted,
There you are!
Lovely weather, isn't it?
I turned in time to see a truck fender spiraling toward us.
Down!
I tackled Calypso and Leo, provoking more screams of agony from the sorceress. The truck fender sailed over our heads and slammed into a dumpster, sending up a festive explosion of garbage confetti. We struggled to our feet. Calypso was shivering, no longer complaining about the pain. I was fairly sure she was going into shock. Leo pulled a staple gun from his tool belt.
You guys go ahead. I'll hold them off as long as I can.
What are you going to do? I demanded. Sort and collate them?
I'm going to throw things at them, Leo snapped. Unless you've got a better idea.
Both of you stop, Calypso stammered. We don't leave anyone behind. Now walk. Left, right, left, right. We emerged from the alley into a wide-open circular plaza. Oh, why couldn't Indianans build a proper city with narrow, twisting streets, plenty of dark corners, and perhaps some conveniently placed bomb-proof bunkers? In the middle of a ring-shaped drive stood a fountain, surrounded by dormant flower beds. To the north rose the twin towers of another hotel. To the south loomed an older, grander building of red brick and granite, perhaps a Victorian-era train station. On one side of the edifice, a clock tower soared roughly 200 feet into the sky. Above the main entrance, under a marble archway, a colossal rose window gleamed in a frame of green copper, like a stained glass version of the dartboard we used for our weekly game night on Mount Olympus. That thought made me heartsick with nostalgia. I would have given anything to be back home for game night, even if it meant listening to Athena gloat about her Scrabble scores. I scanned the plaza. Our ghostly guide seemed to have disappeared. Why had he brought us here? Should we try the hotel? The train station? Those questions became moot when the Blemyai surrounded us. The mob burst out of the alley behind us. A police car swerved into the roundabout next to the train station. A bulldozer pulled into the hotel's driveway, the operator waving and calling out cheerfully,
Hello, I'm going to bulldoze you!
All exits from the plaza were quickly blocked. A line of sweat freeze-dried against my neck. An annoying whine filled my ears, which I realized was my own sub-vocalized whimpering of, Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. I won't die here, I promised myself. I'm much too important to bite it in Indiana. But my trembling legs and chattering teeth seemed to disagree. Who has an idea? I asked my compatriots. Please, any brilliant idea? Calypso looked like her most brilliant idea at the moment was trying not to throw up. Leo hefted his staple gun, which didn't seem to frighten the Blemyai. From the midst of the mob, our old friend Nanette emerged, her chest face grinning. Her patent leather pumps clashed terribly with her blonde leg fur.
Gosh darn it, dears. You've made me a bit miffed.
She grabbed the nearest street sign and single-handedly ripped it out of the ground.
Now please hold still, won't you? I'm just going to smash your heads with this.
3. My last performance. Some old lady drops the mic and kills everyone. I was about to initiate Defense Plan Omega, falling to my knees and begging for mercy, when Leo saved me from that embarrassment.
Bulldozer, he whispered.
Is that a code word? I asked.
No, I'm going to sneak over to the bulldozer. You two distract the metalheads.
He shifted Calypso's weight to me.
Are you crazy?
She hissed. Leo shot her an urgent look, like, trust me, distract them. Then he took a careful step sideways.
Oh,
Nanette beamed.
Are you volunteering to die first, short demigod? You did hit me with fire, so that makes sense.
Whatever Leo had in mind, I imagined his plan would fail if he began arguing with Nanette about his height. Leo was a bit sensitive about being called short. Fortunately, I have a natural talent for focusing everyone's attention on me.
I volunteer for death, I shouted.
The entire mob turned to look at me. I silently cursed my choice of words. I should have volunteered for something easier, like baking a pie or post-execution cleanup duty. I often speak without the benefit of forethought. Usually it works out. Sometimes it leads to improvisational masterpieces, like the Renaissance or the Beat Movement. I had to hope this would be one of those times.
But first, I said, hear my plea, O merciful Blemyai.
The policeman who Leo had torched lowered his gun. A few green embers of Greek fire still smoldered in his belly beard.
What do you mean? Hear my plea.
Well, I said, it's customary to hear the last words of a dying man. Or god, or demigod, or... What would you consider yourself, Calypso? A titan? A demi-titan?
Calypso cleared her throat with a noise that sounded suspiciously like, idiot.
What Apollo is trying to say, O merciful Blemyai, is that etiquette demands you grant us a few last words before you kill us. I'm sure you wouldn't want to be impolite.
The Blemyai looked aghast. They lost their pleasant smiles and shook their mechanical heads. Nanette shuffled forward, her hands raised in a placating manner.
No, indeed, we are very polite.
Extremely polite,
the policeman agreed.
Thank you, said Nanette.
You're welcome,
said the policeman.
Listen then, I cried. Friends, frenemies, Blemyai, open your armpits and hear my sad tale.
Leo shuffled back another step, his hands in the pockets of his tool belt. Another 57, 58 steps, and he would arrive at the bulldozer. Fantastic.
I am Apollo, I began, formerly a god. I fell from Olympus, cast down by Zeus, unfairly blamed for starting a war with the giants.
I'm going to be sick, Calypso muttered. Let me sit down.
You're breaking my rhythm.
You're breaking my eardrums. Let me sit.
I eased Calypso onto the fountain's retaining wall. Nanette raised her street sign.
Is that it? May I kill you now?
No, no, I said. I am just, letting Calypso sit, so she can act as my chorus.
A good Greek performance always needs a chorus. Calypso's hand looked like a crushed eggplant. Her ankle had swollen around the top of her sneaker. I didn't see how she could stay conscious, much less act as a chorus. But she took a shaky breath and nodded.
Ready?
Lo, I said. I arrived at Camp Half-Blood as Lester Papadopoulos.
A pathetic mortal, Calypso chorused. Most worthless of teens.
I glared at her, but I didn't dare stop my performance again.
I overcame many challenges with my companion, Meg McCaffrey.
He means his master, Calypso added.
A 12-year-old girl.
Behold her pathetic slave, Lester, most worthless of teens.
The policeman huffed impatiently.
We know all this,
The Emperor told us.
Shh, said Nanette. Be polite.
I put my hand over my heart. We secured the Grove of Dodona, an ancient oracle, and thwarted the plans of Nero. But alas, Meg McCaffrey fled from me. Her evil stepfather had poisoned her mind.
Poison! Calypso cried. Like the breath of Lester Papadopoulos, most worthless of teens.
I resisted the urge to push Calypso into the flower bed. Meanwhile, Leo was making his way toward the bulldozer, under the guise of an interpretive dance routine, spinning and gasping and pantomiming my words. He looked like a hallucinating ballerina in boxer shorts, but the Blemyai politely got out of his way.
Lo, I shouted, from the Oracle of Dodona we received a prophecy.
A limerick most terrible.
Terrible,
Calypso chorused.
Like the skills of Lester, most worthless of teens.
Vary your adjectives, I grumbled, then continued for my audience.
We traveled west in search of another oracle. Along the way, fighting many fearsome foes, the Cyclopes we brought low.
Leo jumped onto the running board of the bulldozer. He raised his staple gun dramatically, then stapled the bulldozer operator twice in the pectorals, right where his actual eyes would be. That could not have felt good, even for a tough species such as the Blemyai. The operator screamed and grabbed his chest. Leo kicked him out of the driver's seat. The police officer yelled,
Hey!
Wait, I implored them.
Our friend is only giving you a dramatic interpretation of how we beat the Cyclopes. That's totally allowed while telling a story.
The crowd shifted uncertainly.
These are very long last words, Nanette complained. When will I get to smash your head in?
Soon, I promised.
Now, as I was saying, we traveled west.
I hauled Calypso to her feet again with much whimpering on her part and a little bit on mine.
What are you doing? She muttered.
Work with me, I said.
Lo, frenemies, behold how we traveled.
The two of us staggered toward the bulldozer. Leo's hands flew over the controls. The engine roared to life.
This isn't a story, the police officer protested. They're getting away.
No, not at all.
I pushed Calypso onto the bulldozer and climbed up after her.
You see, we traveled for many weeks like this.
Leo started backing up.
Beep, beep, beep.
The bulldozer's shovel began to rise.
Imagine you are Camp Half-Blood, I shouted to the crowd.
And we are traveling away from you.
I realized my mistake. I had asked the Blemyai to imagine. They simply weren't capable of that.
Stop them!
The police officer raised his gun. His first shot ricocheted off the dozer's metal scoop.
Listen, my friends, I implored. Open your armpits!
But we had exhausted their politeness. A trash can sailed over our heads. A businessman picked up a decorative stone urn from the corner of the fountain and tossed it in our direction, annihilating the hotel's front window.
Faster, I told Leo.
Trying, man, he muttered. This thing wasn't built for speed.
The Blemyai closed in.
Look out!
Calypso yelled. Leo swerved just in time to deflect a wrought iron bench off our dozer blade. Unfortunately, that opened us up to a different attack. Nanette threw her street sign like a harpoon. The metal pole pierced the bulldozer's chassis in a burst of steam and grease, and our getaway ride shuddered to a halt.
Great, Calypso said. Now what?
this would have been an excellent time for my godly strength to return. I could have waded into battle, tossing my enemies aside like rag dolls. Instead, my bones seemed to liquefy and pool in my shoes. My hands shook so badly I doubted I could unwrap my bow even if I tried. Oh, that my glorious life should end this way, crushed by polite, headless people in the American Midwest. Nanette leaped onto the hood of our bulldozer, giving me a ghastly view straight up her nostrils. Leo tried to blast her with flames, but this time Nanette was prepared. She opened her mouth and swallowed the fireball, showing no sign of distress except for a small burp. "Don't feel too bad, dears," she told us. "You never would have gained access to the Blue Cave. The Emperor has it too well guarded. A shame you have to die, though. The naming celebration is in 3 days, and you and the girl were supposed to be the main attractions in his slave procession." I was too terrified to fully process her words. The girl? Did she mean Meg? Otherwise, I heard only Blue Die Slave, which at the moment seemed an accurate summary of my existence. I knew it was hopeless, but I slipped my bow from my shoulder and began to unwrap it. Suddenly, an arrow sprouted between Nanette's eyes. She went cross-eyed, trying to see it, then tumbled backward and crumbled to dust. I stared at my blanketed weapon. I was a fast archer, yes, but I was fairly sure I hadn't fired that shot. A shrill whistle caught my attention. In the middle of the plaza, standing atop the fountain, a woman crouched in faded jeans and a silvery winter coat. A white birch bow gleamed in her hand. On her back, a quiver bristled with arrows. My heart leaped, thinking that my sister Artemis had come to help me at last. But no. This woman was at least 60 years old, her gray hair tied back in a bun. Artemis would never appear in such a form. For reasons she had never shared with me, Artemis had an aversion to looking any older than, say, 20. I'd told her countless times that beauty was ageless. All the Olympian fashion magazines will tell you that 4,000 is the new 1,000. But she simply wouldn't listen. The gray-haired woman shouted, "Hit the pavement!" All around the plaza, manhole-sized circles appeared in the asphalt. Each one scissored open like the iris of a camera, and turrets sprang up. Mechanical crossbows swiveling, and sweeping red targeting lasers in every direction. The Blemyai didn't try to take cover. Perhaps they didn't understand. Perhaps they were waiting for the gray-haired woman to say please. I, however, didn't need to be an archery god to know what would happen next. I tackled my friends for the second time that day, which in retrospect, I have to admit, felt a wee bit satisfying. We tumbled off the bulldozer as the crossbows fired in a flurry of sharp hisses. When I dared to raise my head, nothing was left of the Blemyai but piles of dust and clothing. The gray-haired woman jumped from the top of the fountain. Given her age, I was afraid she might break her ankles. But she landed gracefully and strolled toward us, her bow at her side. Wrinkles were etched across her face. The skin under her chin had begun to sag. Liver spots dotted the backs of her hands. Nevertheless, she held herself with the regal confidence of a woman who had nothing left to prove to anyone. Her eyes flashed like moonlight on water. Something about those eyes was very familiar to me. She studied me for a count of five, then shook her head in amazement. "So it's true. You're Apollo." Her tone was not the general, "Oh, wow, Apollo," sort of attitude I was used to. She said my name as if she knew me personally. "Have we met?" "You don't remember me," she said. "No,
I don't suppose you would.
Call me Emmy.
And the ghost you saw, that was Agamethus. He led you to our doorstep. The name Agamethus definitely sounded familiar, but as usual, I couldn't place it. My human brain just kept giving me that annoying memory full message, asking me to delete a few centuries of experiences before I could continue. Emmy glanced at Leo. Why are you in your underwear?
Leo sighed. Been a long morning, Abuela, but thanks for the assist. Those crossbow turrets are the bomb diggity.
Thank you, I think.
Yeah, so maybe you could help us with Cal here, Leo continued. She's not doing so well.
Emmy crouched next to Calypso, whose complexion had turned the color of cement. The sorceress's eyes were shut, her breathing ragged. She's badly hurt. Emmy frowned as she studied Calypso's face. You said her name was Cal?
Calypso, Leo said.
Ah.
Emmy's worry lines deepened.
That explains it. She looks so much like Zoe.
A knife twisted inside me.
Zoe Nightshade.
In her feverish state, Calypso muttered something I couldn't make out.
Perhaps the name Nightshade.
For centuries, Zoe had been Artemis's lieutenant, the leader of her hunters. She'd died in battle just a few years ago. I didn't know if Calypso and Zoe had ever met, but they were half-sisters, both daughters of the Titan Atlas. I'd never considered how much they looked alike. I regarded Emmy. If you knew Zoe, then you must be one of my sister's hunters. But you can't be. You're... I stopped myself before I could say old and dying. Hunters neither aged nor died, unless they were killed in combat. This woman was quite obviously mortal. I could sense her fading life energy, so depressingly like mine. Not at all like an immortal being's. It's hard to explain how I could tell, but it was perfectly clear to me. Like hearing the difference between a perfect fifth and a diminished fifth. In the distance, emergency sirens wailed. I realized we were having this conversation in the middle of a small disaster zone. Mortals, or more Blemii, would soon be arriving. Emmy snapped her fingers. All around the plaza, the crossbow turrets retracted. The portals closed as if they'd never existed.
We need to get off the street, Emmy said. Come, I'll take you into the way station.
4. No building should be a secret from Apollo, or drop bricks on him. We didn't have to go far. Carrying Calypso between us, Leo and I followed Emmy to the big, ornate building at the plaza's south end. As I suspected, it was a railroad depot at some point. Carved in granite under the rose window were the words, Union Station. Emmy ignored the main entrance. She veered right and stopped in front of a wall. She ran her finger between the bricks, tracing the shape of a doorway. Mortar cracked and dissolved. A newly cut door swung inward, revealing a narrow chute like a chimney with metal rungs leading up. Nice trick, Leo said. But Calypso's not exactly in wall-climbing condition. Emmy knit her brow.
You're right.
She faced the doorway. Way station? Can we have a ramp, please? The metal rungs vanished. With a soft rumble, the chute's interior wall slanted backward, the bricks rearranging themselves into a gentle upward slope.
Whoa, said Leo. Did you just talk to the building?
A smile tugged at the corner of Emmy's mouth.
The way station is more than a building. Suddenly, I did not fancy the look of that ramp. This is a living structure, like the labyrinth, and you expect us to go inside? Emmy's glance was definitely the look of a hunter. Only my sister's followers would dare give me such a malodorous stink eye. The way station is no work of Daedalus, Lord Apollo. It's perfectly safe, as long as you remain our guests. Her tone suggested that my welcome was probationary. Behind us, the emergency sirens grew louder. Calypso inhaled raggedly. I decided we didn't have much choice. We followed Emmy into the building. Lighting appeared along the walls, warm yellow candles flickering in bronze sconces. About 20 feet up the ramp, a door opened on our left. Inside, I glimpsed an infirmary that would have made my son Asclepius jealous. A fully stocked supply cabinet with medicine, surgical tools, and potion ingredients. A hospital bed with built-in monitors, GCI interface, and levitating bariatric slings. Racks of healing herbs dried against the wall, next to the portable MRI machine. And in the back corner, a glassed-in habitat, seethed with poisonous snakes. "Oh my," I said. "Your med bay is cutting edge." "Yes," Emmy agreed. "And Way Station is telling me I should treat your friend immediately." Leo poked his head into the infirmary. "You mean this room just appeared here?" "No," Emmy said. "Well, yes. It's always here, but it's easier to find when we need it." Leo nodded thoughtfully. "You think the Way Station could organize my sock drawer?" A brick fell from the ceiling and clunked at Leo's feet. "That's a no," Emmy interpreted. "Now, if I can have your friend, please?" Leo pointed to the glass habitat. "You got snakes in there? Just saying." "I'll take good care of Calypso," Emmy promised. She took Calypso from us, lifting the sorceress in her arms with no apparent difficulty. "You two go ahead. You'll find Joe at the top of the ramp." "Joe?" I asked. "You can't miss her," Emmy promised. "She'll explain the way station better than I could." She carried the sorceress into the infirmary, the door shut behind her. Leo frowned at me. "Snakes?" "Oh, yes," I assured him. "There's a reason a snake on a rod symbolizes medicine. Venom was one of the earliest cures." "Huh." Leo glanced at his feet. "You think I can keep this brick at least?" The corridor rumbled. "I would leave it there," I suggested. "Yeah, think I'll leave it there." After a few more feet, another door opened on our right. Inside, sunlight filtered through pink lace curtains onto the hardwood floor of a child's room. A cozy bed was piled with fluffy comforters, pillows, and stuffed animals. The eggshell-colored walls had been used as a canvas for crayon art. Stick figure people, trees, houses, frolicking animals that might have been dogs, or horses, or llamas. On the left-hand wall, opposite the bed, a crayon sun smiled down on a field of happy crayon flowers. In the center, a stick figure girl stood between two larger parental stick figures, all three of them holding hands. The wall art reminded me of Rachel Elizabeth Dare's Cavern of Prophecy at Camp Half-Blood. My Delphic oracle had delighted in painting her cave with things she'd seen in her visions, before her oracular power ceased to work, that is. Totally not my fault. You can blame that overgrown rat snake python. Most of the drawings in this bedroom seemed typical for a child of about 7 or 8. but in the farthest corner of the back wall, the young artist had decided to inflict a nightmarish plague upon her crayon world. A scribbly black storm was brewing. Frowning stick figures threatened the llamas with triangular knives. Dark curlicues blotted out a primary colored rainbow. Scratched over the field of green grass was a huge inky sphere, like a black pond. Or the entrance of a cave.
Leo stepped back. I don't know, man. Don't think we should go in.
I wondered why the way station had decided to show us this room. Who lived here? Or more accurately, who had lived here?
Despite the cheerful pink curtains and the pile of stuffed animals on the carefully made bed, the bedroom felt abandoned, preserved like a museum exhibit.
Let's keep going, I agreed.
Finally, at the top of the ramp, we emerged into a cathedral-like hall. Overhead curved a barreled ceiling of wood carvings, with glowing stained glass panels in the center, creating green and gold geometric designs. At the far end of the room, the rose window I'd seen outside cast dartboard-lined shadows across the painted cement floor. To our left and right, there were raised walkways with wrought iron railings, and elegant Victorian lampposts lined the walls. Behind the railings, rows of doorways led into other rooms. Half a dozen ladders stretched up to the ornate molding at the base of the ceiling, where the ledges were stuffed with hay-like roosts for very large chickens. The whole place had a faint animal scent, though it reminded me more of a dog kennel than a hen house. In one corner of the main room gleamed a chef's kitchen big enough to host several celebrity cook-offs at once. Sets of sofas and comfy chairs were clustered here and there. At the center of the hall stood a massive dining table of rough-hewn redwood with seating for 20. Under the rose window, the contents of several different workshops seemed to have been disgorged at random. Table saws, drills, lathes, kilns, forges, anvils, 3D printers, sewing machines, cauldrons, and several other industrial appliances I couldn't name. Don't judge me. I'm not Hephaestus. Hunched over a welding station, throwing sparks from her torch as she worked on a sheet of metal, was a muscular woman in a metal visor, leather apron, and gloves. I'm not sure how she noticed us. Perhaps the way station chucked a brick at her back to get her attention. Whatever the case, she looked in our direction, shut off her torch, then lifted her visor.
I'll be hexed, she barked out a laugh. Is that Apollo?
She tugged off her safety gear and lumbered over. Like Emmy, the woman was in her 60s. But whereas Emmy had the physique of a former gymnast, this woman was built for brawling. Her brawl